Hi everyone, welcome back to the FENSCast, your podcast from FENS, where we chat with some prominent neuroscientists from the FENS community. And today we're chatting with Professor Ewelina Knapska, who is a neuroscientist based in Poland. She works at the Nenki Institute of Experimental Biology in Warsaw, where she also did her PhD before moving to the US to Ann Arbor in Michigan for a postdoc. She then returned to the Nenki Institute, and she has been the associate professor and the head of the laboratory of the neurobiology of emotions, where she studies the role of areas like the amygdala in phenomena such as emotional contagion in animal models. So, Ewelina, welcome to the podcast. Can I ask you, first of all, about how you got into this area?
Hi, it's a story that started when I was a PhD student, and we noticed the performing experiments in rats that when an animal that was trained in some kind of aversive training, so something unpleasant happened to him, when it came back to the home cage where other animals were waiting for their turn to be trained, actually the other animals' behavior was changed. They started to be agitated, they started to follow the one that was already trained, and we just realized that they catch fear of this animal that was already trained. So we decided to look at it closer to develop the model that will allow us to test it in a more controlled way, which neural circuits in the brain are activated and which circuits actually mediate such fear contagion, because we call it fear contagion.
That's fascinating work. And I imagine the amygdala plays a big role in this process. What do you think is the contribution of the amygdala there?
Oh yeah, so in the first step, we focus on my favorite structure, which is the amygdala. So the amygdala, as you said, is very important in processing of directly experienced emotions. So we ask the question whether or also with socially experienced emotions, so the ones catch from others, are mediated by the neuronal circuits in the amygdala, and we found that indeed there are the similar circuits in the structure that mediate fear that it's emotional, that is socially perceived. So yeah, it's very important structure also for social emotions.
Right, and how do you think these phenomena, like emotional contagion, how do they manifest in humans, or what's different about human manifestations of it compared to animal models, for example?
Well, we are not so far away from other animals. So emotional contagion, in particular fear contagion, can be observed in different species, also in humans. And recently we looked at what's activated in the human brain. We were interested whether we learn equally well fear from friends and strangers. So what was predicted from the theory that is commonly accepted is that we should be more empathetic toward friends, so we should learn fear better from them. But it appeared not to be true. We both friends and strangers are equally good source of information for us. And the same set of structures is activated in both cases. So it seems that at least in the case of fear contagion, it's more about information than empathy or social interaction per se.
Wow, that's really interesting. And I suppose makes sense, maybe from an evolutionary perspective. Why do you think it is, and maybe the answer is evolutionary, that this type of learning, and particularly the amygdala, seems more important for negative types of emotion like fear and panic or anger? Why do you think they're special in the brain, if you like?
I think it's not the whole truth. For many years, people focus on the amygdala as a structure that is crucial for fear learning and fear expression. But we know that some neuronal circuits within the structure are also very, very important for positive motivation. For example, motivation for food, and also, as it appears, for social interactions. So this is what we are actually looking at right now. We are interested in the neuronal circuits in a part of the amygdala that it's called central amygdala. that mediate motivation for social interaction and also some aspects of transfer of information of positive emotions. So it seems that it's equally important for positive emotions, also the social emotions.
Ah, that's really, really exciting because, yeah, you don't hear very much about positive emotions in a lot of this research. It's usually fear potentiation, you know, fear responses, but that's really exciting. So you use animal models a lot in your work. How do you go about those studies? What do you do in the lab to study these phenomena?
Okay, so we work mainly in animal models. So we use mice and rats. And the simplest models, one of animals is subjected to some stimulation that is supposed to evoke emotions, either negative or positive ones. So it may be fear, fear conditioning. So an animal is subjected to usually food shocks, something unpleasant. And in case of positive emotions, we usually feed animals. They both rats and mice like good food as we do. So the reward system is activated and they show some like approach behavior. They like to eat. They like to go to the places where the good food is. And we can ask the question whether they actually can, like interacting with the animals that were recently fed, a naive animal that didn't eat recently, can get information and can read the these positive emotions of a partner to be better in finding food in the environment. So this is what we are working on right now.
Okay, and the use of food as an important stimulus in the work is really interesting because, again, I think in humans, it's something we can relate to. So do you think there's some underpinnings there for specific responses to food in terms of maybe conditions like anorexia or bulimia?
It's a very good question. I mean, of course, you know, naturally in rats or mice, we don't see anorexia or bulimia, but the etiology of these diseases are more complicated, but there are some physiological mechanisms that control food intake. And I think at this level, we can find some parallels between what we see in rodents and in human brain.
That's great. And I suppose it corresponds a little bit with some of the work on the gut-brain axis as well. And we're understanding that relationship a bit better. Now, I know in your research, you use techniques like optogenetics. Can you tell us a bit about that and how that contributes to your research?
Oh, yeah, it's actually the development of optogenetics was very instrumental for us because we wanted to see whether the neuronal circuits we see activated during this emotional transfer are important actually to control behavior. So to see it, we developed the constructs that use expression of CFOS. CFOS is a protein that is expressed in the neurons that are activated. So we can introduce, using these constructs, we can introduce to these neurons that are activated during social interaction, some constructs, optogenetic constructs that allow us to reactivate these cells later on. So then we can test what happens when we reactivate these circuits for example, in a novel environment and whether they help the animals to adapt to the environment. And this is what we actually found when we reactivate the circuits activated by interaction with a fearful partner. The animals, depending on the level of emotional arousal on the partner, these observer animals, so the ones that just witnessed the emotions of the partner, can either easier find the source of danger, exploring cautiously environment to find the source of danger, or they hide. If the level of emotions is high, they hide and try to avoid danger. So it's like it was very instrumental to show that what we observed at the activation level is really important to adapt to the environment.
Yeah, it's a fascinating technology, and I think the applications of it have been really exciting in the last few years. So I want to ask a little bit next about your own journey and your career trajectory, because you did your PhD in Poland in the Nenke Institute, and then spent some time in the US at Ann Arbor, and then returned to Poland later. So talk us through your journey a little bit, and what motivated you to come back from the US?
Well, you know, it was the postdoc time in Ann Arbor, University of Michigan. It was the lab of Steve Maren. It was very important for me and very formative period. It was the time when I got interested in fear. And so it was like direct fear, not social fear. But I learned a lot. But after 2 years, I decided to go back because there were some opportunities to start my own lab here. So I thought that it's a really good opportunity to study what I'm really interested in, that is the social emotions and fear contagion at the time. So this was my main motivation to come back. And also, of course, this is my country. I was born here. I was raised here. It's a lot of things have changed over the last 20 years, I think, for better. So I'm happy to be a part of this change. So it's also, of course, my motivation.
Great. And of course, being back in Europe, I suppose, and being a member of FENS gives you exposure to EJN, our society journal. So I wanted to ask a little bit about your view of society-related publications versus more general or private ones. What's your view on that publication process?
You mean in general, the publication process? Well, it's not perfect, for sure. But I think we are in a time of a change. So I think that the bioarchive and other kinds of archives are becoming more and more important. So they allow for fast sharing of discoveries. I feel that we are in a process of a change. I hope that it will be for better. But of course, the classical publications are important, as we have this peer review process, which is, I think, necessary. But if we would be able to combine what we have, I mean, what archives offers, and what peer review process and more traditional way is offering, it would be great. So we'll see.
Yeah, and on one of our podcasts, we spoke with John Fox from EJN, and it was really interesting to hear about the evolution of EJN and their processes and how it's worked. So it'll be really interesting to see how it evolves in the future. Now, next, I want to ask you about your exposure to the FENS-CAVLI program, the Network of Excellence. You were a FENS-CAVLI scholar in 2018. How did you get involved with the program?
Well, I've heard about it from my mentor, actually. So when it was created, I thought that it's a great idea, and I was right. So I really enjoyed being a part of the network. I think because there is like a group of excellent scientists, that's obvious, but also people who are very involved in their communities and in the scientific community in general. So it's very inspirational for me. Here in Poland, I'm involved in creating a new unit. It's like in the institute where I work, I'm co-chairing a unit that is a partnership with EMBL. So we are trying to introduce the rules of operating that are not so common in Poland, like recruitment process, then training process for PhD students and postdocs. So getting in touch with people who work in different European countries, discussing the problems we have here, it's very important for me. And it's also an inspiration, so I'm really enjoying it.
Right. And what did being a member of the network involve? What did it involve? Did you meet regularly? Were there online seminars or activities? Or what was it like to be a member of the network?
It's great. I mean, we meet regularly in person. And before the pandemics, it was more regular. During the pandemics, it was more online. But I think this in-person meetings are very important, as you can know people. and it's easier to get to know people, you know, in person than online. That's obvious. But we discuss science, but we also discuss different, like, functioning of science. So, like, scientific policy, publishing, which you mentioned, but also outreach or mentoring problems that we all deal with in our everyday lives. So it's, I think it's very important.
Right. And I think you've mentioned that your interest in advocacy and engagement and outreach kind of developed with the Defence Network. Can you tell us a little bit about your advocacy activities?
Well, yes, I'm devoting some of my time to outreach. I think it's very important. So I'm giving public lectures, of course. I'm also organizing some classes for gifted children. We have here a very nice initiative that is called Polish Children Funds. And they are supporting the development of gifted students from the middle and high schools. So we are organizing workshops. We are organizing some individual stays in the lab. The kids are very enthusiastic, so it's very, very rewarding. I really like the initiative. But also I'm involved in promoting the idea of animal research, which is very important nowadays. There are many people who are against. And of course, it's ethically, it's difficult. But I think that we are not in now we are not yet the moment, the time that we can resign from the animal experiments. So we are, of course, looking for alternative methods, but still to develop them, we need animals. So I'm involved in, currently I'm involved in the cost action that it's devoted to development of home cage monitoring of rodent behavior in biomedical research. So the others on one side, it helps to develop better, more reliable methods of animal experimentation, which is important to reduce number of animals and improve quality of their living, and also to improve the results we get. But also I'm trying to stress and I'm trying to convince people that we need to do these experiments.
And when you bring up that topic with the public, what is the response like? Is it mainly negative or is it mixed, or what have you experienced?
Well, usually it's not negative. When you think about it openly and explain to people why we do it and how the research looks like, people are not so negative. I mean, a lot of resistance against such experimentation stems from the fact that people actually don't know about how it really looks like. So I'm trying to explain how we treat animals, and we treat them really well. So, and first of all, what is the aim of such studies and why we do it? So I think it's not so negative after all, when people actually know what we are doing and why.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's one of the reasons why outreach and engagement with the public is so important, just to, you know, to reveal some of these processes and let them understand what happens. So finally, let me ask you, if someone listening to this podcast was considering getting involved with the Defence Cavi Network, why, in your opinion, should they? And what will they benefit from being a member of the Defence Cavi Network?
Well, first of all, I think it's a great inspiration. It's an opportunity to meet really interested people and really involved you know, in what they are doing, and in the if you are interested in having some impact on policy making, scientific policy making in Europe, on the outreach mentoring issues and publishing issues. There are subgroups of people interested in different topics. So if you are interested in any of them, I think it's a great place to be and to join the network.
And have many of your contacts from your time in the network maintained since you finished that experience, or are you still in collaboration with some of them?
Yes, I actually started some collaborations, so we are in touch, we visit each other, and we have some common scientific projects. And also there are alumni of Fens Kavli Network, and we organize some meetings from time to time to stay in touch.
It sounds fantastic, and it sounds like a great program to get involved with. Thanks so much, Evelina. It's been fantastic to have you on the podcast today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Fenscast. Before you go, Fens would like to remind you that the Ebro travel grants to attend the Fens Forum will close on 21 September. And mark your calendars, because the call for satellite and networking events will open on 13 September. So make sure to prepare your proposals in time. But wait, there's more. Fens and Ebro Perk offer an exclusive chance to spend up to 3 months in a top European lab. Apply now and receive up to 4,000 euros to cover your travel and accommodation expenses. The call is open until 15 October. Thank you for listening, and join us for the next episode of Fenscast. Don't forget to follow us on Fens.org, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube.